bring back nine, and they leave three permanently attached to the space station. So, because they do this four different times, they eventually wind up with 12 batteries that will never come back. They're going to be attached to the space station forever. Not functioning, but, you know, to a pallet that's bolted to the truss section. I guess in the future, if they wanted to, they could probably take those batteries and maybe put them on another cargo vehicle, or, you know, if they had room in the future, I guess they could take them and burn them up too and just get rid of them. But that's stirring them. Back to you, Doug.
Okay, I was just curious because I'm kind of into science fiction, and there have been stories where we have got so much junk in space that you can't fly anything up there anymore.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I have so many satellites now. I mean, there's roughly about 1,000 or so operating satellites. But there's like 10,000 that are not operating that are just dead that they keep track of. And now with the internet, they want to have internet satellites up there. They're planning, like Elon Musk is planning on putting like 12,000 satellites up there. He's already got 60 up. By the end of this year, he's going to have at least three more flights. So that'll be another 180 satellites just for him. And then other groups have plans on putting up satellites. But yeah, the batteries, it's not like they're going to let it just fly around up there. They plan on deorbiting everything as best they can. Very good. So that's the story on that. Now, another thing that they would like to fix is this Alpha Magnetic Spectroscope that's permanently attached to the International Space Station. They brought it up there some years ago, and it worked very good. It's looking at, dark matter and positrons and all these high-tech things that scientists would love to look at. So it's degraded over the years. There's one pump that's failing. They need this pump to keep it cool. So what happened is they're bringing up parts for it and tools, special tools. It was never designed to be repaired, not this particular pump and setup. Was never really designed to be worked on by astronauts. So they had to develop this whole plan. It's kind of like the Hubble. Certain parts of the Hubble were never planned to be replaced either. And they had to do that on one of the five missions in particular. They had all kinds of problems. One of the handles were in the way in a Hubble, and they decided, let's just rip it off. One astronaut, he's from New York, I forget his name, begins with an M. I'll think of it. And he comes from New York. He ripped the handle right off it. They gave him the okay to do it, and they were worried about him, of course, ripping his spacesuit or something in the process. But the handle wouldn't come off. The bolt was stripped out. And whatever, this guy saved the day. By doing that, they were able to get to, I think it was a power supply or something that they were trying to change out. They changed out everything on that thing, all kinds of gyros and this and that. But this thing was not meant to be serviced, this part of it. And it's going to be the same way with this spectrometer, this alpha magnetic spectrometer. They're going to have the same kind of thing. So they're expecting 5 or 6 spacewalks to fix it. So I'm not sure what's involved with this. But they would like to get it back online. It turned out to be very successful. They weren't sure how good it was going to be, but they liked all the results that were coming back. So now it's a lot cheaper to repair this thing than build a new one and send it up. So it's not like the Hubble where they're going to go away from a space station to do it at. This thing is actually attached to, I think, the starboard S1 truss. They have it permanently attached looking up in the zenith position, looking at the universe as it goes around. So that's the deal with that. Let me drop it for a second. A new crew was also launched the day after HTV went up from Japan, and they sent a new crew up to join the six people that are up there. So one person's from NASA, and it's a woman named Jessica Meir. She's got some kind of doctorate, and she's joined by Oleg. What's his name? Gira Paklia, I think it is. And he's the pilot for the Soyuz spacecraft. And then they brought up what they call a participant, which really amounts to somebody that paid or somebody that's paying for them to go up and visit the space station. They haven't done this for 10 years. I think they've done it around 8 or 9 times in the past. And that now the Russians are resuming this. This is something the Russians want. That, you know, you could be a private citizen and you come, you know, cough up enough money and they'll take you up to the space station. In this case, the United Arab Emirates paid for Hazza Ali Al-Mansouri to take a ride on the Soyuz spacecraft. So he's up there now with them. Now that makes these spacecraft, the International Space Station, 9 people. There were 6 people up there, so now you have 9. You have 4 from the United States, 2 guys and 2 women. You have 3 commanders for 3 separate spacecraft. There are now 3 spacecraft, crew spacecraft, attached to the space station, all by Russia. Different Soyuz rockets. Each one holds 3 people. And then you also have another port that's filled with Progress space stations. So all the ports are filled, as far as the Russians are concerned. But what they're planning on doing is 8 days from now, probably 7 days now, they're going to deorbit. I believe his name is Haig, and the fellow he went up with, the Russian Oleg, will be flying back, and they're going to be bringing the guy from the United Arab Emirates. He's only staying for 8 days. And then you say, well, what happened? Where are they getting the extra seat? The extra seat is, you know, when they went up, when Haig went up, and the Russian commander went up, Oleg, they also brought with them Christina Koch. Christina Koch has gotten the okay to have an extended mission. Usually they go up there 5-6 months. But they said, no, that's okay. You could stay up there like 11 months. So she's on an extended tour, similar to what Kelly did, Mark Kelly, or Scott Kelly, rather. Scott Kelly. His brother Mark is twin. He was down on Earth at the time. They ran tests because they were twins. They were comparing the two together. So Christina Koch is going to be an extended trip. She's going to break all the records for women and everything. And eventually they'll bring her back, probably around 6 months from now. But it's interesting, talking about Kelly, the last time you had 9 people on board, similar setup was when he was up there in 2015, you know, roughly 4 years ago. So that's the story with that. Like I said, if you want to go see these 9 people fly overhead, you can download the app or you can listen to this net, and I'll give you the best times to observe it from the New York area. This is WS2F. Any other comments or questions before we continue? Okay, another flight that I'm looking forward to getting off the ground will be something called Launcher 1. And Launcher 1 is being being built by Virgin Galactic. Actually, they split off the name. Virgin Galactic now split off another name. It's called Virgin Orbital. As far as I'm concerned, it's the same thing. It's all Richard Branson, the billionaire from England, that's doing this stuff. And he's the guy that's building Spaceship One. Now Spaceship Two. Spaceship One crashed in a test a couple of years ago. Spaceship Two will eventually be bringing paying passengers up to the common line, not orbital, but into space, and then come back on a runway. They're going to start doing this and land in Texas probably by the end of this year, more likely the beginning of next year. But Launcher One is, like I said, a spinoff of Virgin Galactic, which is going to have the paying passengers. And Launcher One is their version of relatively small satellites, 500, maybe 1,000 pounds, into orbit. And the way they're going to do it is they take a 747 and they're attaching Launcher One, this rocket, to the bottom wing, the port wing of the 747. They're going to fly it up to 45,000 feet, drop the payload, and then the Launcher One will ignite and put something into orbit. And they're hoping to do this in the fall now. They're looking maybe another month or two. So they're getting ready. They've already tested the 747 with Launcher One. They filled it up with water instead of fuel, and they wanted to see how it would react, you know, in particular with the plane, when you drop this big load, and, you know, is it going to throw the controls off on the plane? Is the rocket going to fall straight through? You know, that type of thing. So they've already done that. So the next time is going to be a launch. Now, if he's successful at doing this, he'll be able to go to a customer and say, okay, you want a satellite where? No problem. You know, one inclination, we can go anywhere. We can take off from different runways around the world, and we can put it into polar orbit, equatorial orbit, you know, whatever you like. And like I said, with the internet satellites going up there soon, some of them are already up there, like the ones by SpaceX called Starlink. SpaceX will be launching their own, but there's other companies that would like to launch these things too, as well as other scientific satellites. So there's a lot of companies involved with relatively small satellites, 500 to 1,000 pounds. And this is just one of them. Another one is the Electron rocket by Rocket Lab. They presently launch out of the North Island of New Zealand, and soon they will also launch out of the United States. Actually, a United States company, you know, it's registered in California. So presently, Rocket Lab is building a launch facility in Virginia and Wallops Island. It's going to take over one of the launch complexes down there. That launch complex is already being utilized by Northrop Grumman to launch the Cygnus spacecraft on the Antares rocket. That also goes to the International Space Station. It's a cargo vehicle. So that's the story on Launcher One. Any comments or questions? Okay, now, it's been advertised, if you follow this type of thing, on the internet, that Elon Musk was going to make an announcement last night about the update of his Starship. He's building something called the Starship. His ultimate goal is to go to Mars and, you know, set up a colony there and become a two-planet, faring species for the human race. But in the meantime, he's building Tesla electronic cars with big batteries. And he's got solar systems. city was, you know, setting up solar panels all over the place, all over the United States and probably around the world. And he's got this main business that he really loves called SpaceX. He's been launching the Falcon 9 for quite a few years now. In fact, it's been exactly 11 years yesterday, since the 28th of September, that he first launched what was called Falcon 1 from the Kwajalein Islands in the Pacific into orbit. That was his first orbital successful flight. So he uses that date every year to give an update on his company and what he's doing and what changes he's made. And this year is no different. So he came on last night. He was supposed to come on at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. A little late, probably around 9:30, and then he ran around 40 minutes. And this time he was transmitting from Boca Chica, Texas. That's where he has one of his launch complexes built. He's already launched a couple of suborbital rockets from there. But he plans on launching the Starship from there as well. Especially the Mark 1 will be an upgraded version of something he launched a month or two ago called Starhopper. Starhopper was very successful. It looked like a big, gigantic garbage can. It was 30 feet in diameter, 65 feet high, but it took off and it flew 150 feet high, no, around 500, let's see, that was around 500 feet high, and then it moved over and came back and landed. Now he retired that experimental piece. But from that same launch complex in Boca Chica, he plans on launching the Mark 1 Starship first. He's building an identical one called the Mark 2 in Florida right now, and it's coming along pretty good. I mean, it looks like Boca Chica beat them out. They started earlier, so he's got two different crews working on, you know, they're working against one another and picking up different tips as they go along on building this thing. It's 164 feet high and 30 feet in diameter. And that's this new Starship that he was showing off last night in his presentation. And right now, instead of having one Raptor engine is also built by SpaceX. That's what they used. They buy that for the test Starhopper a month or two ago. He's also using the same engines, and these are powerful engines. He's using three of them, each one producing 440,000 pounds of thrust. That, you know, presently he launches the Falcon 9, for years now. He's successfully sending up satellites to space. Satellites to the L1 position, 1 million miles away from the Earth, four times the distance of the Moon. Successfully, the Discover project. He sent up space telescopes like TESS, which is presently operating now, looking for habitable satellites or habitable planets around different stars. Falcon 9 is a real workhorse, and now he's eventually going to have that. Within months, maybe, or less than a half a year anyway, he'll be able to send a crew to the International Space Station on the Dragon on top of the Falcon 9. The Falcon 9 engines, design engines, so each one is called Merlin. He had different iterations, you know, Merlin A, B, C, you know, that type of thing. He's up to D. And each one puts out at least 220,000 pounds of thrust. It started out a lot less than that, and it worked its way up to 220. This new Raptor engine, it puts out 440,000 pounds of thrust. Each Raptor engine is fed by liquid oxygen and liquid methane, where on the old system, on the Falcon 9, he's using an RP-1, rocket propellant number one, essentially it's kerosene. You know, it's filtered out kerosene. I mean, it's very pure kerosene. They chilled that down to, you know, extreme temperatures. They chilled the liquid oxygen down to the point where not only is it liquid, it comes close to freezing. The denser the oxygen, the more power they can get out of these rockets. So, same thing here. There's extreme cold liquid oxygen and liquid methane in this case. So CH4 is what they're using to launch methane rockets. He made this announcement last night. He has to use it's a higher ratio of liquid oxygen with methane compared to when you use RP-1 with kerosene. It's roughly a little over 2 to 1 for kerosene. You know, 2 tons of oxygen to 2 tons to 1 ton of kerosene, and in this case, it's 4 to 1. So, when you look at this rocket, standing 164 feet high, 30 feet diameter, there's two tanks in there, and the biggest one is by far, it's like 4 to 1 ratio, is liquid oxygen. So, you're flying mostly liquid oxygen when this thing will take off, and he thinks within a month or two. He has three engines already mounted. He has pictures of that. I have that here. Eventually, I guess I can post that onto RoyAZ2GS.com website, and as well as some other pictures of what the new Starship vehicle looks like. You know, there's some changes that have made to it. I mean, physical changes that you can see. For instance, he had three fins coming out on the original one. Out of each fin, in each fin, he had a leg. So it was serving a dual purpose. He had a fin to guide through the atmosphere plus a leg. But he figured out that the cost to weight ratio wasn't worth it to do that. In fact, instead of using three fins, he's only going to use two fins in the back, and a large fin. And then he's got instead of the three legs, he's using six legs for more stability. So six legs are going to open up to when this thing eventually lands. Like I said, that he's looking for maybe a couple of months from now, trying to do that test. We'll talk about that on the net if he ever gets that thing off the ground, because that's going to be quite a scene to see. Instead of going up this 500 feet, he's going to send this thing up 12 and a half miles. I can imagine this thing launching from Boca Chica, Texas, going straight up to 12 and a half miles. I mean, once the airplanes go up to, what is it, 6 miles or something, 30,000 feet, 7 miles. This thing's going up to 12 and a half miles. It gets kind of thin over there, so he'll be able to test out his nitrogen jets for controlling the attitude of the vehicle when it's up there. It's got this cold fire firing nitrogen jets near the top, so he'll be able to adjust it and get it just right where he can start coming back down through the atmosphere. Now, these things are all reusable. That's the idea of his whole company. Now, this thing's going to come down through the atmosphere, and it's got these fins on it, like I was saying. Got two big fins in the back, and it's got two smaller fins in the front. And essentially, they're almost like wings. He described it as like a skydiver coming down. You know, you open up your arms and legs, and you kind of balance yourself as you're coming down through the atmosphere. So that's what he plans on doing. To control the fins, I found out last night, I was kind of surprised. He's not going to use hydraulics. You know, everybody uses hydraulics to control any kind of fins on these things when they're controlling things. Going through the atmosphere with these rockets, they usually use the fuel from, you know, from the rocket as it's passing through, going on a way to the rocket combustion chamber. Before it gets there, they usually tap off, and if a valve tap off, and it usually controls these fins that they have to. He's doing away with that 100%, and he's going to control them with electric motors. And that's why he said earlier, in a week or two before, they saw massive lithium batteries coming in from, from his plant in out west. And, you know, he has the Tesla car company, like I said before. So they're taking Tesla car batteries that they normally would put in a car, and they're bringing down, and they put, I think, three of them into the Mach 1 Starship. And the job of those batteries are going to be to control these motors on these wings, as this thing is coming down through the atmosphere, this is going to balance itself. You know, it knows its, you know, location in space. And so it's going to be guiding itself not only to the runway, but, you know, making sure it doesn't flip over one way or the other. It's only going to have a heat shield on the windward side of the vehicle as it's coming down. The leeward side, nothing. And the other, the way he could do this is because he's got, instead of using an aluminum skin, like most of these rockets today, he's making it out of stainless steel, all welded stainless steel. And that's how he put this thing together. So it goes straight up in the air, 30 feet in diameter. And he doesn't have a nose cone on it. And his ultimate goal is to put like 40 or, you know, they claim 100 people, but like 40 people into the front of this thing. And, you know, head off to Mars. But to do that, it's not, you know, you're not going to be able to take this one rocket that's 164 feet and get all the way to Mars. In fact, once you launch this rocket, you could get it to orbit, but they don't think you would have enough fuel to make it back. So, you know, you're really going to lose the rocket if you do that. To do that, you'd have to take this whole rocket, raise it up 168 feet high, and put it on top of another booster. This other booster is called a Super Heavy booster. It's going to have these same Raptor engines, each Raptor engine producing 440,000 pounds of thrust. And instead of having, you know, this test vehicle has three, and eventually it's going to have six. The Super Heavy is going to have like 35 of these rockets engines, maybe 30. He might even get away with 28, depending on what he's launching. But even at that lower number, he's looking at twice the amount of thrust than you would get out of a Saturn V rocket that went to the moon. Saturn V, seven and a half million pounds of thrust, 7.7 actually, million pounds of thrust. He's looking to double that with these Raptor engines. Instead of five engines like the Saturn V, they're going to have like 35 engines up to that number. So that will get him to orbit. You know, he'll be able to launch the Starship, the one that they are now, will be able to put into orbit. It'll have plenty of fuel on board to orbit the Earth, especially in the earlier test models. It will have cargo doors, you know, where you can open up the cargo doors and put satellites in space if you'd like on that version. And then it would be able to deorbit, you know, turn around in space, fire its methane engine to slow it, start slowing itself down. It's going to have six engines on board. It's going to have three for, you know, coming up through the atmosphere, and then three that are really geared for in a vacuum. So he'll be able to slow himself down and eventually come back and land where it took off, right next to where they took off, you know, maybe, you know, a couple thousand feet away from the launch pad itself. And now, so that gets you to orbit and back. The Super Heavy booster, we're not going to throw that away. SpaceX says, we're going to save that. So as this thing goes up and pushes the Starship into orbit, Super Heavy spacecraft with 30 Raptor engines is also going to come down through the atmosphere, and it's going to come back and land roughly where it took off, and that's also going to be reusable. So the whole thing, everything is going to be reusable. Then he's got one other final thing that he has to do to make this all work to eventually go to the moon. By the way, I have a good picture of what he thinks it's going to look like with a Starship in the vicinity of the moon. I'll put that on Roy's website next week as well. To get to the moon, or for that matter to Mars, you would need to, before you left orbit, you know, the way it is now, you could use the Super Heavy, get to orbit, and then you could have enough fuel to do what you have to do in space, and then come back and land. You have enough fuel for that, but you don't have enough to get to the moon, land on the moon, and come back, or the same with Mars. So you need to refuel first. So he's going to send, you could imagine trying to get to the moon. The launch would be Super Heavy, 30 engines, push the Starship to orbit. The Super Heavy comes back and lands. That's reusable. The Starship is now in orbit around the Earth. And here comes another Super Heavy launching another Starship, except this one's got nothing but fuel in it. They go up, and they turn tail to tail. They back up tail to tail in orbit. And the fueling vehicle, which looks like the same vehicle, it looks like the same Starship, it will refuel the existing Starship that's up there and has a crew in it ready to go to the moon. The fuel vehicle separates and saves enough fuel for itself, because that's going to come back and land back in Boca Chica, Florida, Texas, or Florida. He's got a launch complex in Florida that he's building right now, so right now he'll be able to take off from two places. And then now this fuel vehicle will now be able to go to the moon, land on the moon, deliver people, cargo, still have enough fuel to take off from the moon and come back to Earth, and come back and land on Earth, have enough fuel to slow itself down from 25,000 miles an hour to a propulsion landing with crew and everything back to where you came from. So that was his speech last night. If you would like to see his speech, I think he's more entertaining than I am. You could go to his website, SpaceX webcast. You put that in, and he probably has that up there now. This occurred last night, so I'm sure it's up there now. And you could watch the whole thing, and he'll have it up there probably for some time. And then even in the future, I'm sure you could get on the web and you put in, Elon Musk's presentation from September 28th, 2019, about the Starship, and I'm sure it will come up. So that's the story. Any comments or questions for this part of the SpaceNet report? This is WS2M.
I got some further comments, Paul, about Elon Musk on a slightly related subject.
Oh, sure. Go ahead, Dick.
I'm looking at the January 2019 issue of IEEE's magazine called Spectrum, which I get. And they talked about Elon Musk's Starlink concept, where he launched two satellites in February of 2018. He labeled that one Tintin A and Tintin B. And these are going to be the trial satellites for a system, for his Starlink system, which was going to consist of, maybe it's still going to consist of, almost 12,000 total satellites. 7,500 are in very low Earth orbit, and 4,400 are in low Earth orbit. Total of 11,943 altogether is the proposal. And each one of these satellites, because they're so low to talk to a ground station, will only be able to have them above the horizon for 5 minutes. So each satellite of these 12,000 satellites is only above the horizon for 5 minutes. Therefore, in order to communicate from point A to point B, the satellites have to act like a, what do they call it now, a matrix or a, I can't think of what word to use, a mesh system. The satellites have to all talk to each other to relay the signal. To your knowledge, what is the status? Has he really gotten permission to launch 12,000 satellites? Man, he's going to fill up the sky with all kinds of projectiles that will stop anybody from launching anything else. Is he going to follow through with that project, or has he put that one on the shelf for the time being? Because those first two satellites didn't do what they were supposed to do. So what's the current status of his Starlink system, Paul? WS2N, K2IW. Sounds a little crazy to me.
Yeah, he took those two satellites. That was a launch. He was launching something for Germany. I think they were the two new GRACE satellites. They're experimental. They study the gravitational pull of the Earth. He was launching two of them, but he had room on board, so he launched two of his own Starlink satellites as an experiment. And he learned a lot from that and redesigned everything. And the new ones don't look like that. And he set up a factory. Now he's mass producing these things right now. He did launch 60 of them a few months ago from Vandenberg Air Force Base. And I saw them all lined up inside the fairing, which, I mean, it was heavy. It was like, 30,000 pounds of these things. And went off without a hitch. Instead of all this mechanisms to separate them, one at a time as they normally would be done, he had them all lined up, all stacked up like in a deck of cards, and then he got it to orbit, and then fairing separate, and it exposes these satellites, and then they release them all at one time. They the ones in front, had a little different momentum than the ones behind it. And they moved away from one another slowly. They all have, a GPS type of thing on it. They know where they are in space. And they have thrusters on board, and they were able to maneuver to their proper locations. I think two of them failed since they launched them. And then another two were designed to fail on purpose. He wanted to test the deorbiting capability of these things. What you do is, each one has one long solar ray on it when it opens up on a 500-pound satellite. And if you make the satellite look, like a sail going into the direction of travel. Even so, you're in space. There are atoms up there. It's very rarefied, but it's enough to start slowing the satellite down. So he wanted to test that, and it worked successfully. He was able to deorbit two of them, and he make sure that works because he plans on, like I said, 12,000 satellites. The government wants to know that, if there's a problem with these things, you can get them back. He doesn't want to just keep adding more, If it doesn't work, I'll set up another 1,000, It's not one of those deals. If it don't work, it has to be able to come back, and it has to be able to come back pretty much on its own without any kind of thrusters. The other two that failed out of that group of 60, they did the same thing where they faced the panel into the direction of travel, and they are presently still up there, but they were going to eventually deorbit quick. So that's the story. And then, he plans on. I checked the manifest for the launches for the rest of the year. I believe there's three more launches like that. Three more 60. Each launch is 60 satellites to the end of the year, so it gives you another about 180 more. Satellites to add to that group by the end of the year, and then a lot more next year. Let me drop it. He plans on launching, it's already, you know, in the books, he plans on launching 24 SpaceX launches, just like that, 24, each one with 60 satellites on board, all throughout next year, you know, so he's got a lot of customers, you know, he's got NASA, you know, he's going to launch cargo vehicle to the space station. In fact, he's got a new cargo vehicle that will debut next year as well. And he's also got a crew vehicle that's supposed to be going up very shortly. So, you know, NASA, he launches for other countries and companies that they will take priorities. But he hopes to get 24 of his own rockets launched. And the reason he could do that is because he's saving all these boosters. They come back, you know, and relaunches them over and over again. He's launched, I think one of them has actually gone up four different times. Some of the boosters have gone up three times. I think he's got one where, I'll have to check. I think there's one that is done for you. They're designed to launch 10 individual times. And then after 10 times, you don't throw them away. You just rework the booster and do it for another 10 times. And he expects 100 flights out of every booster. So, with no problem, he'll be able to get his 12,000 satellites up there. Yeah, it's a go. I mean, he's got a factory making these things. Dick, back to you.
Yeah, you did say back to me, and sorry, I was away from the mic. Wow. Of the 60 that he's launched, and you said two of them failed, he's happy with the other 58? Are they communicating with each other in this mesh network? Are they at the right altitude? And so they're so successful, he's going to launch all these zillions of others? How are the first 58 really doing, and how much testing has taken place? Paul, go ahead.
I don't know. I would imagine they're testing these things all the time. He needs, I think he said he needs 1,000, roughly 1,000 to start selling subscriptions. So, and like you said, they're going to be in two different orbits. You know, it's going to be higher orbit and lower orbit. I think one is at, you know, 400 miles, and the other one's going to be something, you know, higher than that, 700. So two layers of these things. So, I'm sure he's testing them all the time. I guess he's happy with them. They said they're mass producing them, you know. This is what you got. This is what you do when you got $1 billion. You open up not only three companies, but four companies. He's got the car company, Tesla Automobiles. He's got the SpaceX. He's got SolarCity. And that's not good enough. He's got to open up this factory, which is pushing out these satellites like, you know, cookie cutter. Then he's got this, supposed to be the biggest building, I don't know, in the world or something. He's got this massive building in Nevada somewhere where he's making these, I think it's called the Gigawatt building. I don't know. They're making all these batteries for the car. Yeah. You know, I've seen pictures of it. You know, it goes on for acres and acres and acres. It's a massive building. So this is what you do when you know, you got plenty of money there.
WB2EAZ with a question.
WB2, is it VAB? Or, no, I think I got that wrong.
EAZ, quick question. The very low Earth orbit satellites, don't they hit some minor but finite air resistance, and they will eventually age out and fall back to Earth? What kind of lifetime and provisions do they have for that?
Yeah, I don't know how long they're designed to actually last. You know, I guess it's, you know, like most satellites, geosynchronous satellites go up and last for 15 years. That's the number for them. I don't know how long they want these things to last, but he set it up where eventually they will eventually fail. Nothing lasts forever. where you can turn it. He's got momentum wheels on, you know, inside these satellites, you know, so you spin them up and they'll face the solar panels forward and that will quickly deorbit it. So, yeah, there's some rarefied gas there, so I'm sure that they're going to have a shorter life, of course, than the 700-mile ones. Back to you.
Yeah, well, that's my point. Eventually, they will fall back to Earth. The question is how long. I'm not talking about these units failing just like, you know, the radios we're talking on to fail. I mean, failing by eventually falling down.
Yeah, well, he'll plan on deorbiting them over the ocean when he gets good at it. With all those thousands of satellites, I'm sure he'll get real good at being able to deorbit it over the oceans. I don't think, you know, maybe the materials on board, you know, if they make it back to the Earth, will just wind up into the ocean. That's why all these cargo vehicles, except for Dragon, which comes back, all the cargo vehicles burn up over the South Pacific. So I guess depending on their orbital inclination, that will probably be the goal to, you know, to turn the satellite at a certain time, be able to predict, you know, where they're going to come down and land. And they'll have to be able to know about the ionosphere and, you know, if you have a lot of solar activity, there's going to be more ions and stuff in the atmosphere. I'm sure all these things will probably be taken into consideration, I would think. And as they burn up, new ones are going to go up, you know. So, like Dick said, there's going to be one big mesh network. So if one fails or a couple hundred fail, you know, who cares, I guess. You know, they'll all link together somehow and they'll be replaced.
Paul? He wants to launch a total of almost 12,000 of these satellites. In order to do that, who gives him permission to do that? Who really controls space and how many things you can launch into it? FCC? Intelsat? Who does he get permission from to launch all these things? Because they're all going to be hazards to a hell of a lot of other things that are going to be launched at a later time. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
I'm sure Intelsat is part of it. You know, well, they're really big on the geosynchronous satellites, but maybe they're involved with the other ones as well. I know there was problems in the beginning because they were going to work on 2.4 gigs was one frequency, and then I forgot what the other frequency was. I thought it was higher. There's another frequency that they're going to use, two of them. And they were worried about interfering with the geosynchronous satellites, you know, and they apparently worked that out. You know, as the transmissions would be coming down, you know, they were worried about them, you know, intermodulation or whatever it may be, you know, or just general interference with all these satellites. And apparently they must have worked that out. I mean, that was a big problem a couple of years ago when they were talking about this. OneWeb is one of them. I think OneWeb is financially in trouble. I think they're pretty much out. They wanted to put around only 600 satellites up, but I haven't heard much from them. Maybe they'll make a comeback. You know, some of these companies are like submarines that come up with under a different name. But who controls it? I'm sure it's the our government is part of it, and I'm sure they must have contracts or, you know, I mean dealings with the other countries, you know, and I'm sure they're going to be doing the same thing. You know, eventually China's going to say, well, I want to put up a couple of thousand satellites. So, you know, what's going to happen? Back to you, Dick.
According to this article, the low Earth orbit satellites of the Starlink system are going to transmit on KU and KA, I think it is, 7.5 to 18 gigs. Wait a minute now. I'm confusing the numbers. There it is. 12 to 18 gigs is KA band, KU, and KA is 26.5 to 40. So the low Earth orbits are between 12 and 40 gigs, and the very low Earth orbits are going to transmit between 40 and 75 gigs. Wow. The ones he's launched so far, these are the low Earth, not the very low Earth orbits. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, I know he's doing the low orbits first. And, you know, it's probably going to be a combination of the two, sure, you know, to make it operational. But, yeah, I knew it was two frequencies. I just didn't know which ones they were. So, yeah, they're way up there in frequency. And, you know, they're going to have all these gateways down below, you know, you transmit. Now, if you're out in the middle of nowhere, I guess you can have your own receiving antenna, transmitting antenna. But probably to some degree they'll have gateways, you know, you come down and maybe they, from there they'll go out on the internet. I don't know, I haven't researched that system yet. Now, there's, you know, there's Amazon, although, you know, he's way behind as far as all the stuff is concerned. He has plans on putting up thousands of satellites to this Jeff Bezos, you know, for an internet. And there's one other company, at least one other company, that wants to do the same thing. But you can imagine, you know, as time goes on, you know, you have 10,000 non-operating satellites now. You're going to add 12,000 operating satellites. You're doubling it, over doubling it. It's going to be a nightmare for NORAD. They must have something to do with it, too. You know, they're the ones that got to track all this stuff there.
Most things that operate on 12 to 40 gigs use highly directional antennas because you're not transmitting a lot of power. You can't easily go omni. So it sounds like he's going to be uplinking and downlinking to gateways. He hasn't proposed to talk to the individual customers, has he? I mean, if I sign up for his service, does that mean I've got a dish in my roof that talks directly to the satellite? Somehow I'm very skeptical of that because at these low Earth orbits and very low Earth orbits, they're only above your horizon for like 5 minutes at a time. And so if they're not putting out a whole lot of power so you can transmit to them with an omnidirectional antenna, the antenna on the ground has got to be aiming at the darn thing. There's a lot of missing information here, Paul. Has he made any of that clear to your knowledge in 2EO? I mean, WS2N, KQIW.
I remember going on about the flat panels. So it'll be phased array antennas using pretty flat, low profile. You know, there's going to be a curve to it to some degree. So I know that's part of it. And he's got all kinds of patents on these not only the ones in space, you know, they're going to be low profile, but the receiving antennas are going to be like that too. But yeah, if you're on an island in the middle of nowhere, or you know, or some rural area in some backwoods area of Indonesia, someplace, or wherever you're at, you know, you know, or even in Montana somewhere. You know, you could be at a ranch with, you know, not a cable, and, you know, for 100 miles. You know, you might need your own personal gateway there.
I've forgotten the name of the Iridium, yes. What's the current status of Iridium? I think that was handed over to the military because it wasn't economically viable to... as a private concern. Is that true, Paul?
I thought it was still private, but they're dealing mostly with the military. But other people are involved with it as well, you know. These environmental research vessels and things like that, you know, they have to communicate. They're using the Iridium. So, that's not, you know, the military has their own Iridiums, you know, what are they called? They use Iridium too, but they have secured satellites that they use all the time. So they have their own, I'm sure. I forget the name. And then Iridium is basically communications and emails and texts and things like that. But these Starlink things are really, you know, cablevision, you know, in the air. You know, you're going to have everything you have here. You'll be on your computer. You could use it for Echo Link. You could use it for, you know, phone communications. You know, everything. You know, maybe TV, right? I mean, why not? Maybe you're going to get all your TV stations from there too. Now, I don't know. I haven't heard that one yet. But it's all digital. You could do it.
Do you believe Starlink is going to talk to the individual customers without a gateway station? Pulling this all together, go ahead.
I believe it's going to be both. I mean, I'm sure the gateway thing is going to be the number one thing. You know, you could have an antenna, you know, maybe in Hot Park over here, and then maybe from there it's going to go into the internet. I don't know. It would be a lot cheaper for him to, you know, pay for usage going through the network of paying somebody else to do what's already here. And all he needs to do is to get, you know, to and from space. So my guess is something like that. To set up his own infrastructure for something that's already here, I don't think so. I think he's going to blend in with the internet.
I'm having trouble believing he's going to make any profit on this one. Over to you, Paul.
I don't know, but 5-10 years ago when I was reading about this, he plans on making a profit. That's how he's going to fund his countless rockets that are going to go to Mars and set up his city. He wants a colony up there.
That colony up there is very hard to believe. There's a darn many hardships of Mars. No air pressure, ridiculously cold temperature, high radiation. I mean, any one of these things, maybe you could find ways around it. But to have all of those conflicts, all of these disadvantages simultaneously, to send a colony, it has to be self-sustaining. To be self-sustaining, you've got to grow your own food. Tell me how the hell you grow your own food on Mars. You can't put up greenhouses because to create the air pressure at 2 tons per square foot, for 14 pounds per set per square inch, 2 tons per square foot. You can't put normal glass on a greenhouse and grow plants up there. So without the colony being self-sustaining, you'd have to have a continuous supply of tremendous number of spacecraft bringing you food, air, water, bringing you all the consumables. You can't sustain that if at 100 to 300 million mile range between Earth and Mars, a Congo line of a continuous supply ship to supply your colony. That's not going to take place. Over to you, Paul, KQIW.
That's tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2VL repeater. That time complete.
That sounded good. Okay. Yeah, I don't know. Dick, did I send you a couple of pictures? Did I send you the one with the starship at the moon or the one on Mars? I think I sent you one on moon. Do you remember?
Right now, I don't remember. How long ago and what was in the picture?
Oh, I probably sent eight hours ago, you know, roughly couple of these topics that were going to be on the net. I sent you a couple of pictures that eventually I wanted to send over to Dr. Roy. So, today.
You gave me the email. I've got that. And you said at the bottom there's pictures. On what I got from you, there was no attachment, Paul.
Okay, that's odd. There were 4 pictures. All right. Well, whatever. I'll send them over to Roy, and then you'll be able to look at them over there. And it's really impressive. That's all. Yeah, I attached it to the email. It was all one. Yeah, that went out. Let me check. Yep, went out. Gonna come back. There's another picture that he posted last. It was part of his presentation of, you know, his rocket ships on Mars. and its colony there, and this modern-looking building, you know, and it's got glass all over it. You see people standing.